this week, the two nations signed a treaty that basically recognised each other's sovereignty. Obviously, these things were here before in a cultural sense, in a tribal sense. But this is a treaty between governments. And so that was a pretty exciting time. So one of those things is the military facility. We'll talk a little bit about that and the importance of that. Hey, Bill and Gunnan, welcome to Black Law Tribal Edition. Murumu here with you today. And we've got Yirilim and Ganyara in the studio, and Bomi is out and about and getting ready for, I guess, the continued Waka Waka Yidinji talks. This week, the two nations signed a treaty that basically recognised each other's sovereignty. Obviously, these things were here before in a cultural sense, in a tribal sense, but this is a treaty between governments, and so that was a pretty exciting time. We'll talk a little bit about that and the importance of that, as well as a few other, let's say, international things. So one of those things is the military facility, a Navy base called Diego Garcia, which is sort of in the Indian Ocean somewhere, and it's a very, very small part of a group of islands, and it has a Navy base on there that's quite strategic for the West in terms of the collective West, US, UK, and all that kind of stuff. But now the Chagossian, the indigenous people, have been have asserted their sovereignty, and now it looks like they're going to take control of that particular installation, Ganyara, and there are fears that they may bend towards India and China, considering that India and China are more of a neighbour than the UK and the US. And that seems to have some sort of issues and potential impacts around the globe if that indeed does transpire. Tell us a little bit about the history and the background to that.
You've got to understand the history to understand what's going on. So with that location there, it's very strategic to the West, very, very strategic, especially it's the eyes and ears for the US in that part of the world there, because I know their aircraft can reach the Middle East from there, especially their strategic bombers. They can reach from there and assert the will of the global police force, the US. You know, that's their job. We go back many years when the British come and just took it as they did everywhere else, as their expansion of the empire, you know, the empire where the sun never sets. That one, because they had the territories across the globe, right around the globe. So, you know, not only Australia, but there's also a place like the Falkland Islands or this place here in Chagos there. So they took it. They actually just rounded up the indigenous people off that island and took them away, just dragged them off. You know, sounds a bit like a mission to me, you know, where they round up the Aboriginal people here and dragged them off into the missions and put them in some far-flung place and just said, okay, you sit there, no money, no compensation, we're just taking your place. But in 1960, the world started to reverse its position, said, look, all the colonial world must go. All the colonial empires, you know, the British one, French, the Germans, the Dutch, the Portuguese, the Spanish, all had to go back home to where they come from. And who had that placed over there? That was 1960. That was the British had there. In the meantime, they'd leased out this this island to the American military. Now, did they have the right to lease out that island to the American military? That's the question that's really at stake. And quite obviously, because of this, what's going on now, they didn't have the right, the legal right, the lawful right to lease that out to anyone, because that belonged to the people from Chagos there. Wonder what that was all about. Now, you see with what's going on at present, there's some pretty big sums of money being talked about, some pretty big figures. I think there's an initial payment of $244 million I wouldn't say compensation, but there's a fee payable, and it's payable every year now after the first initial payment to the people of Chagos there. That can reduce to $166 million annually adjusted for inflation. Now, that's a lot of money for a little place. That's how important it is for the American military. It's their eyes and ears. That also reminds me of Pine Gap over in central NT next to Alice Springs. There's a radar installation there or an intelligence gathering site there, which is speaks to satellites. So once again, that's the base, by the way, that doesn't exist, but everyone knows it's there. But did the Australian government have the right to actually lease that land to the American military? It's the same here with Diego Garcia. Now, as we decolonise and the world goes back to where it all rightfully come, did the British actually decolonise there properly, or did they have the lawful right to do this? And under Article 28 of the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples, this is where the money comes in. Go and read Article 28. Article 28 says, you know, you've got to be, if you can't get the place given back to you, you've got to be given some money or given land of equal stature somewhere else. Now, there's nowhere equal to that for them people. So there's only one thing that can be done, and that's the money. So this is where it's all at. And, you know, it's actually quite a threat to the assertion of power or projection of force into the Indian Ocean by the American military. If that base goes, where's their next land base? You know, that's the biggest thing we've got to look at. And that's why they're talking about places like Darwin or the Australian military installation, but still it's a long way from the Middle East where there's a lot of conflict at present with all this turmoil going on. So Diego Garcia is very, very important to them. Or they've got to fly out of Cyprus or somewhere else, and you're getting too close to the action for strategic bombers to be located. So there's a hugely important strategic location sitting there. It's in the Indian Ocean. It's off India. But we are now arguing, the West is collectively arguing with places like India and China and Russia. This is the BRICS nations. Who's it close to? Who's that island close to? It's very close to India. It's off the west coast of India, out in the ocean. I think they might have a right to it, and maybe they might want to assert sovereignty, or maybe they want to go out and do a better deal with the local indigenous people out there, and that becomes a problem for the US. They're retreating back to their homeland, which is where they've got to go, under the UN Declaration or the General Assembly Resolution 1514 and 1960. Everyone must go back to where they come from.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the dynamics is puzzling in that India is a member of the Commonwealth, for example, but is now distancing itself through the BRICS community away from the collective West. So they have a foot in the door in the West through the Commonwealth of Nations, the largest Commonwealth country on the planet, with, you know, whatever it is, a billion in population. Diego Garcia is, obviously, you've mentioned it and highlighted the strategic importance of it. Things that happen in the Middle East, for example, would definitely the refueling and the maintenance and all those things happening there. You can imagine, like, travelling from Brisbane to Perth and having nowhere to stop in the middle. If you can imagine that, that's what pretty much it's like. Where if you imagine Alice Springs as the centre, then you can stop there and have a rest and fuel up and get some fresh food and whatever. That's what that means, that place means for in terms of a military context. The other important thing is that Russia has announced its a Navy base, I think it is, or a military outpost in Indonesia, or its plans. I'm not too sure if they've gone ahead with that yet, but there's all this going on. The Solomon Islands a few years ago were being trained by Chinese police officers. So China, not only in Africa, has made its Belt and Road initiative, positioned there, made known there, but also in the Pacific. So is Australia part of Europe or is it part of Asia? And this is the dilemma that the Australians face. Now, the Indigenous Nation does not enjoy that dilemma or is not having that dilemma. The dilemma is that Australia is the one that's issuing these security titles over land that it doesn't own. And that's a very important thing. So the real estate agencies, the banks, the government agencies, they're all in it together, but there needs to be, and they've done a good job, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but they're going to have to connect their titles to the root title or the native title, the original title. Here, it's the Yidinji title. So to put anything to bed in the future, if you want to secure the future, settle the past, then you're going to have to come and talk to the Yidinji government. It's simple as that. There's no other way around it, is it?
Funny you mention that. There's a really interesting case the other day or last week in Canada, in British Columbia. The Supreme Court made a really bizarre ruling about land title and Aboriginal title. Basically, the nuts and bolts of that ruling was that around Vancouver, this group were the Cowichan people, that the Canadian-issued land title may not have the right to be over and above the original Aboriginal title underneath. That means that fee simple, be it in Australia, be it there, does not have the right to be on top of the Aboriginal title. It has got no interest. It cannot be there because the Aboriginal title has always been there and the sovereignty has never been ceded properly. It's never been extinguished. It had never been ceded. This is what we've been saying for 15 years now. Australia needs to address that issue here. It's going to come to here where, you know, the coexisting sovereignties, so-called coexisting, and you can't have coexisting sovereignty, as I keep saying, because sovereignty is the ultimate authority over everything else. But you can't have two lots of sovereignty without a formal agreement or a treaty. That's pretty basic knowledge, you know, and it's so simple. So they're trying to keep all our people inside Australia as Aboriginal Australians. But the land titles of Australia have no right, just like they do in Canada, have no right to be over and above Yidinji land titles, for example. Yidinji land title is the first-in-time law. The Justice Dowsett, in a native title determination, said Yidinji have a system of land tenure. They've got a system of authority and decision-making. Government, land title, the Surveyor General. They also have got a system of dispute resolution. That's a court. We've got everything necessary that we need to run a nation. And we were a nation. We always were. We, you know, there was nothing else. But this case out of British Columbia, over parts of Vancouver, are saying that fee simple, the most, I suppose, the most rights you'll ever get inside the Canadian world is being trumped by Aboriginal title. Aboriginal title is everything. Fee simple has no right to be there over title that hasn't been ceded. Now, you know, I can ask everyone around here in the studio today, where did Yidinji lose its sovereignty? How did Australia get its title over ours? And everyone goes, oh, they didn't. They haven't got it. They really didn't do it properly. It's not lawful. I wrote off to an academic, very highly regarded constitutional expert, said, well, what's the go? And he said, you know, he's been talking about this for a while, about the lawful alienation of by the Aboriginal people to give land to Australia. If he's talking about that as a constitutional expert, he quite obviously knows sovereignty's not ceded, territory's not ceded, what have they got? So if he's saying that we've got to give it to them, that means they have nothing right now today as we speak. And this case in Canada is absolutely showing that. It's demonstrating. Now, people go, oh, that's Canada. But hang on. The indivisible crown. This is the British Empire was out there and it was around the world. As I said earlier, this spanned the globe. There was nowhere where the sun didn't, you know, the sun set on the empire. So Canada was part of the indivisible crown. Then in 21, you know, it started to become divisible. The visible crown had come. The crown and right of Canada, the crown and right of Australia, the crown and right of New Zealand. They all stem from one crown that just took land and issued title over it. And the likes of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, when they decolonised, as their version goes, they sent the British land title back to England and they issued their own land title, but they become a manifestation of colonialism. They still had no right. Canada had no right to issue land titles because it was a manifestation of colonialism over the Aboriginal people. Now, if you read that General Assembly Resolution 1540 and 1960, everyone must go back to where they come from, and all those Indigenous people have the right to be free from forced subjugation or whatever. This is what I'm saying. The time has now come for Australia. It's come for Canada. It's now come to Australia now. As Yidinji move forward to this land title, it's going to have a real problem with Australia saying, no, we own the place, and we're always asking, that's what I asked last week, where's the doctrine of ownership?
Yeah, it's a good question and one that I think constitution lawyers are going to have problems solving. But you mentioned something earlier there about Canada and Diego Garcia about all the stolen wealth, the stolen generations, the stolen peoples and all this hurt. There's a very interesting saying that be very careful because the backside you kick today may be the backside you have to kiss tomorrow. And Yirrlim, this is a very interesting position now because somehow Australia in the future, whether it's now or they keep putting off, has to come cap in hand and basically talk to the Yidinji Nation through its government.
Yeah, it's a very interesting position to be in for, you know, obviously Yidinji and all the other many nations throughout the this continent that we're on, that that Australia can't offer a treaty to them. It's the other way around. Only Yidinji can offer a treaty to Australia because we are first in time, as are all the other nations on this country. And it certainly is heading to the point where they're going to have to bite the bullet and, like you said, cap in hand and ask for that opportunity to settle the past and secure the future.
I think it's quite simple. What is the heart of the stubbornness, Ganyara? Is it just people don't want to let go of what they've got, or what do you think it is?
That's a good question. They've got everything to gain and nothing to lose, because Yidinji's been offering this all along. What they will lose, though, is the absolute authority to cruelly the Aboriginal people who actually own this place. And I mean cruel, literally mean that. They are so keeping them so suppressed, keeping them down. You know, we were talking to some people earlier today there about, you know, just getting away from this confusion of Australian law, Aboriginal law. You know, they're just sick of it. Aboriginal people are jack of what's going on. I can't blame them because, you know, every time they turn around, there's this racial profiling going on. But what has Australia got to lose? I don't know. What they do have, if they don't do something very soon, they may lose the ability to issue a land title to another nation, maybe China, maybe Russia, maybe America, maybe England. We can go around the globe and name these international personas, or Yidinji may develop its own international persona, which is where we're actually progressing slowly towards, to where you become a UN member state. You know, you think about the consequence of that. How will Australia say it's complete and intact if Yidinji have developed this international membership of the UN? Now, we'd comply whether we do it or not is another story, but we're developing this international persona that we've always had, by the way, to look after ourselves, because Australia won't do it. Where will Australian land titles go then? What will all the mums and dads of Australia, you know, in the territory become? They'll become Yidinji, will they become Australian, will they become Chinese? Now, this is what I'm saying. So Australia's got nothing to lose other than the absolute authority to dictate to the Aboriginal people what goes on, and that's a big kick for them. But they'll gain all the land title for all the mums and dads, and maybe they don't want that for the average Australian, which is rather sad. If a government was truly genuine of the people, for the people, it would ensure that the hard-earned effort that they went to buy a house with that money is to be secured to them by an Aboriginal title that has every right to be there. It'll secure the fee simple title issued by the state to be linked to the root title, and it'll avoid this, highlight in the courts. It's coming to here. I can tell you now, it's coming, because as Yidinji move forward to assert its sovereignty, we will be taking Crown land, what Australia called Crown land, and we'll reassert our crown on the so-called Queensland Crown land.
I think the other factor to consider is that there are a lot of Australians, Jack, of their own system. So even just me talking over the weekend with people, small businesses are finding it, for example, they may have differing views on the way Queensland's going or Australia's going, but too much red tape, first and foremost. Two, they want something that's honest and fair, and they believe that, you know, they do support Yidinji sovereignty. They want to, and they want to know how they can do that. So there's this goodwill there that people generally want to live together side by side in a fair and just world. So truth, you don't have to sell it, right? People want it. But unfortunately, they don't know what the truth is now in Australia because of all these different things that they've been put forward. I'm not saying all governments are evil, but you can't rely on government for everything. And we found that quite an interesting observation over the last few years in this office here, that people are wanting something that's more real than these promises that officials and people who get elected put as a some sort of foundation.
Yeah, you know, it's happened on both sides where people learn to play the game. And that's where the problem lies. It's not necessarily in the people or the choices that they make, but it's the structure of the game. You know, Yidinji is based on ancient social structures that basically hold fast to the morality actions first. You know, how we treat each other, how we treat the land we're on, are we responsible for it? These factors stand much higher than, you know, making it to the top of the heap, I suppose, with being the person with the most money or the most position. None of these things really stand true. It's about how we work together and how we move forward together.
And it's been my experience too. Like when I visit different nations and their territories and the families that are the original families, I'm always getting welcomed and loved and you can come back anytime. That is a beautiful thing. And that's what people, you know, when you're talking about, I see a YouTube video, the top five greatest, friendliest nations and all that kind of stuff. I can say every nation that I've been to on this continent, every tribal nation that is a friendly nation. I can't even think of somewhere I wasn't welcome. And the top 500, but this is what we're building it on. This is not something like you said, Yerulam. It's ancient. It's not just a punitive, legal only letter of the law type of approach. There's a real spirit of the law as well.
Don't confuse what the average everyday Australian want with what obligations the Commonwealth of Australia has to the United Nations. Remember, it says Resolution 1514, 1960, everyone decolonise and go back to where they come from. Remember that? Now, Australians are a manifestation of colonialism. What do we do with the Australians? When they go to decolonise and give it all back, who do they give it back to? The Australians? Or they've got to give it back to the Aboriginal people? See, that's why I'm saying don't get confused with the average everyday human.
I don't think they wanted to give it back. There is a group of Australians that just don't, they want to keep everyone, including a majority of Australians, in the dark. This is where I think the truth is starting to appear, quite obviously.
That's absolutely right. That's what I'm trying to say. Don't confuse the government stuff with everyday mums and dads. The Commonwealth of Australia, which is the piece of paper hangs on the wall, run by these by people in government, so, you know, a lot of them don't have the interest of the Australians at heart. So I'm saying don't mix that up with the goodwill of the average everyday mums and dads, because most mums and dads are all good. They really do mean the best for everyone, including their own lot, which is fair enough. But it's the legal identity called the Commonwealth of Australia that has obligations under international law to decolonise, to get rid of the manifestation of colonialism. Now, if that goes, where do all the Australian citizens go who are part of that? Now, we'll go back to 2012, Julia Gillard at the miners' meeting. She said, the government doesn't own the resources that you mine. She said, we hold it in trust for sovereign people. If you understand there's a trust in place, and it's not one that the Aboriginal people agreed to, by the way, but there may be a trust arrangement in place. Now, the government are the administrators of the trust. Who are the trustees to the trust? That's the Australian citizens. So that's all one and the same thing. Administrator, trustee, they are one and the same thing. Who are the beneficiaries? Well, the Aboriginal people, maybe. We wrote off to Julia about that when she was the Prime Minister. Julia, what do you mean there's a trust? Tell us about it. We need to know more. Didn't get anything back. But if there's a trust in place, the Australians are trustees to that trust. When Yidinji come back and say, look, you can't have our country now, we're going to look after ourselves, where do the Australians go? So those mums and dads, they're not being told the truth. Like that came out in this court case in Canada, that fee simple cannot beat the Aboriginal title underneath. The Aboriginal title is the ultimate authority on land. Where does that title come from? An Aboriginal government. What government is that? That's Cowichan, that group. Now, what's going on here? Yidinji. We're the ultimate authority on country. We're the ultimate government. We issue the ultimate land title because our land titles haven't been ceded. So they're going to try and stifle the Australian business. They don't want business to keep developing on country because under Article 28, they've got to pay for the place. How do you tell the mums and dads who've busted their boiler trying to make a business have a go at it? You don't own the land. You don't own your house. You've got to move off and go to a 15-minute city or whatever. How do you tell them that?
Well, you know, I think it's good 15 minutes. If we can get from, you know, the Innisfail or somewhere else in 15 minutes, that would be great. But, yeah, you don't want too many traffic jams everywhere. But I know what you mean. The 15-minute city, our idea of a 15-minute city and someone else's idea is probably very alien to each other. But the important thing is that I think one thing that's really, well, there's a number of things I wanted to express today that are really important. One is Yidinji has a solid foundation. The eldership amongst the clan groups is strong as a rock. And that is what this nation and government, its national government, is built on. That's really important. One, it wasn't built on something we just made up yesterday. It was built on, as Yirrlim referred to, ancient structures. And the other thing that's really important to realise is that there's not like 50 million people living on this one land area. There's only, like, you know, maybe 200,000, let's say 250,000, I'm not too sure. But that's manageable. And that in itself is an amazing thing, because we can turn it around quite easily, in that we are doing that. In the last 10 years, the Yidinji Nation through its government is now talk of the town in the legal sphere discussions around the world on Indigenous rights or emerging legal matters. You know, the very fact that the Yidinji national flag flew the highest on the opening of the law ceremony day in their world speaks volumes. I'm not making this stuff up. We never did that. The Yidinji law that continues to live here, that's unseated, hasn't been sold or bargained off, is the spirit of the law is here. So I don't think it's too hard, even in places like Sydney or Melbourne, where they've got millions of people. There are, let's say, modern structures of governance there that can bring that whole system into the line under the tribe. And it's just, it needs direction. That's all it needs. And that's what my encouragement today is, for the nations to direct the vessel. If you've got your government in place, then direct all foreigners on your territory through your customary law and everything else, just direct it. And sooner rather than later, you're going to come together and to start asserting sovereignty and to start to express sovereignty that's not done through an Australian persona, like an Indigenous Australian, for example. But Yirrlim, I can't see anything much more than that, in that it's just totally understanding where you are and then acting like it.
Yeah, of course, yeah, and that's a big journey for a lot of people throughout the world, is, you know, finding and understanding your place in the world, you know. And so for me, it's not been too much of a big step in so far as, you know, being born on country. The country here that I was born onto, Yidinji country, is something that my previous ancestors have come to. So it's not my country to be on. It belongs to the people who were first before anyone else arrived. And therefore, yeah, my house is not my house. It's built on someone else's country. And what's the maximum law going on? You know, what's on your land belongs to you, sort of thing. And so it is a big step. And I've raised this with people before in large groups. And the horror that something doesn't belong to them is quite astonishing, that people are under this impression. And this is where the big learning is going to be, that the land is not theirs.
Yeah, and that's the better news is that the Yidinji Nation is happy to share it, but it has to be fair and just and really reflect those values that are Yidinji values, not foreign values.
Well, we were talking earlier about lawful alienation by the Aboriginal people. That means basically doing a land gift properly. Now, are we going to take the houses off the mums and dads in our part of the world? No, we're not. You know, the average mum and dad work very hard for their what they call their house. So through treaty, which, by the way, what as part of that alienation process will be, is through a treaty, you will gift those sort of land titles to the average mum and dad. You'll marry the Yidinji root title to the Queensland fee simple title, for example. That's fair enough. That's a bit of a go for the poor buggers that just worked hard all their life to try and have a life on this country, which everyone deserves to have a fair go, but Yidinji is not going to do it, you know. We're not going to do it for money, for a start. There's not one Australian dollar can pay for this. They don't have the correct capacity of money. You know, money is just a make-believe fiat, whatever it is. I don't know. It's a barbaric relic anyway. It's not worth it. But we have to do it as part of a negotiation. Remember, Australia's got nothing to give to us. We own the land. We have control over it. We can go and do what we've got to do. We'll do it with Australia, with Canada, with New Zealand, with China. We don't know yet. We've got to work out who's going to do the best thing for us and our people and the Australian people on territory. Now, if the Australians are getting a hard deal, you know, because the government is bashing them too much, we'll say, look, you're not worth doing a deal with. If you're going to hammer your citizens like that, we don't like that idea. So you better ease up on your Australian citizens and give them a fair go. You know, saying about mums and dads trying to build a business and they're getting jack of red tape. All the time you turn around, there's some government official standing over the top telling them, you must do this. That's going to go. We've got to stop that sort of rot and let people have a go. Encourage development, encourage it properly under our direction and supervision of our territory and our resources. If you go and read UNDRIP, the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, the Aboriginal people can control all their resources.
You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition. We'll be back after the break.
Hello, my name is Andrew and I'm from Arnhem Land. My band called Andrew Guruwi Band and you're listening to BBM 98.7.
Welcome back to the show. As we mentioned earlier, the Yidinji Nation and the Waka Waka Nation has successfully signed a treaty this week, which is a wonderful development in the world of sovereignty. It just means that more people are getting familiar with governing themselves and actually walking the self-determination road. And joining us now in the studio is Du Dunham, the Foreign Affairs and Trade Minister, who has been on the show before. Same with Irigala Raj, the Minister for Law, or our version of the Attorney General, I guess, on the Yidinji Territory. And, of course, the Chief Elder and Leader, Nuruku. And we might begin with you, Nuruku. Congratulations. Obviously a massive and historic day for the Waka Waka Nation and the Yidinji Nation moving together.
Yeah, thanks again. And to the listeners out there, I just thank the Lord God Almighty first and foremost for being up here on your country and the privilege to meet your ministers as well. So part of the Waka Waka Nation and what my representative of our people up here.
Nuruku, this didn't happen overnight. Obviously, I remember the very first phone call that you gave me and had Irigala on the line, but this has been brewing in the background for some time, but it's a matter of obligation now for the elders to move forward on both sides of the fence here, and that's what you've done this week.
Yes, virtually the old saying, it won't happen overnight, but it will happen. So that's what I wanted to go have the breakaway from the Waka Waka PBC and then start me own sovereignty as far as where I'm looking to head and to reclaim our lands around the North and South Burnett itself.
It's a huge job, and has it been lonely, or has it, you've obviously gathered a lot of support along the way, but sometimes these things, you're sort of out on the edge. Did that happen to you? Were you by yourself, or did you feel like you were by yourself?
Yes, most definitely, because the fact that I now have 7 ministers under me, 12. Or 12, and because of the fact that I've got a wonderful lady that's working with me, Irigala, and I give all credit to her and the likes of those that are on board with me now that made this happen, and we're going to move forward from this, and I've made the statement as far as your colour. You know, I've got 2 sister-in-laws that are white, and I've got nieces and nephews dark and all shades of colour, so... And I talk about my 7 being ex-army, 26 years all up in the Defence Force to serve Queen and country. So I always talk about my 700 white brothers that I served with in the Defence Force, especially in the infantry, in whether it be 2nd, 4th Battalion in Townsville, 6 years there, as well as 14 years whilst I was based in Darwin in the North Force there. And if those who know North Force, it consists of over 200 of our full-blood soldiers from all the top end. And their role is all about area reconnaissance, coast surveillance. So I apply that principle with the Waka Waka Nation. And like I say, my ministers can back me up on this. I don't give a damn what your colours, because I take all shades of colour, and that's what we're a nation. That's what we're about, Waka Waka.
One of the interesting things you've just mentioned there is that for the Australian Crown or the British Crown, you were happy to defend the realm in a different season and a different time, I guess. But now it's about promoting the Waka Waka Crown, which is literally what it says on the treaty. And that's a different journey now, but one that's has its roots in ancient times as well.
Yes. So as far as me growing up, I was all about joining the armed forces because my grandfather, Robert George Akins, of World War I, served overseas, and he was killed with his three white brothers from Eidsville in the North Burnett. So only one white brother come back, one of the Akins brothers. So he's buried up there at Roybal Station, southwest of Monto. So I was fortunate to go up there and visit the gravesite, and it was a fitting moment to just be there when they had all these cow cockies there on a Memorial Day back in 2004, I think it was, when we came down from Rockhampton to visit and attend with all the other cow cockies, because I was a bugler. So I used to play the bugle in the battalion, in the 2nd and 4th Battalion, and I've been virtually all over Australia just for playing that instrument itself. But as far as getting back to our sovereignty, as I say, it's the importance of having the other, what we say, Miglu mob on board with me to make this happen for the benefits of the Waka Nation.
Dhu Dunham, I'll bring you in as the Foreign Minister. Obviously, you also were signatory to that treaty today, this week, and it's a wonderful thing because it is, I think we read it out on a few months ago, the basic, the gist of it at that time, but it's come to fruition, and it's very exciting times.
Amazing times to be able to be involved in the opportunity for Waka Waka and Yindinji to work together. I'll say brothers and sisters, you know, together. It's the biggest part that I find very rewarding is the opportunity that we have two such likened nations who really work well and have great strengths together, where now we can join those strengths together for synergy and just build just an amazing set of nations together moving forward, the great relationship.
Yeah, it is wonderful. And you know, we heard about the Waka Waka Crown and Nuruka's story in the Australian Room under a different name, a different capacity. But this is the side that needs to be built now so other people can learn about this other story. They're living on a land that has a different name to what they're used to.
Yes.
A whole different relationship there for people to have something that's actually anchored in truth and not just a new story, but it's a very, very old story.
Yeah. This is not about, you know, handing land and doing this. This is nothing to do with it. It's about understanding sovereign and sovereign people working together and allowing people to be free. The silence is deliberate. Let that sink in, because it's about our freedom.
Yeah, it is. Irigala, I'll bring you in. What's the most exciting part of this now? Obviously, the treaties have been signed, but realistically now, what takes place for the Waka Waka Nation in relation to Yindinji? But what are the exciting things that you found with this particular event?
I think what's exciting is because of the growth we've all experienced, even just in the last 12 months since we came up here this time last year. And at that time, all the talk was about learning about our sovereignty. But I think now we've reached a stage where we know we have the sovereignty, but in addition to that, we know that we have the law on our side. And with those things, Waka Waka Nation certainly, and I see our brothers and sisters as well, we're ready to take that next step. We're ready to take action, and those actions will speak louder than words. So people may not be able to see our sovereignty, but they will see the things that we do. And most of those things will be in the area of the land. And there are several areas. So the first one of the first areas will be at Cherbourg, which was the settlement where Nuruku still lives. That land was taken from them. It was actually a prison, although there were no keys. You could not leave without a permit, couldn't get married without a permit. The children were kept separate. They were made to work but didn't have access to their money. And then they built houses and made them lifetime tenants. And so one of the projects we're going to do is reclaim that whole Cherbourg land and give people titles to properties. If they're paid rent for more than 20 years, then it's your house.
Yeah, it's interesting because we talked about what does sovereignty look like, because as you mentioned earlier, it was about learning all about this, but now it's exercising and asserting it. How do you think that will be seen by other nations, not only on this continent but elsewhere as well?
I think we're very fortunate in the South Burnett. We've got a big area in north and south. The Waka Waka territory covers both. It's 80% farmland. We're basically a food basin. And so although we only have 40,000 people, most of them are farmers. And so the other area of land that we will be looking at is how to protect the farmers and how to restore the farmland. And so they will be encouraged and invited to become tribal members of the Waka Waka Nation, and moving their land into our title system will give them protection from the Australian government, from the Biosecurity Act, help them with their debt, because their debt's one of their biggest problems, but also teach them how to produce the best quality food we can possibly have with less poisoning of the ground and so on. So we've already done a couple of those properties, and as we start to do more, that word will spread, and I think it'll be seen as it'll produce more activity in our nation, but I think also other nations, both here and overseas, because I think people are watching what we're doing. And the more we do, we know, and the importance of the treaty is that we encourage and support each other in taking these next steps, because our growth's going along like that. But it will also encourage people overseas to say, and we'll happily help them if that's what's needed.
Dhu Dunamo, I'll bring you back into the conversation. One of the inside of Australia, you listen to some of these constitutional lawyers and their experts saying that Australia is one of the highest nations with these, they call micronations. So they're sort of like novelty governments, or, you know, the principality of this, that and the other. And that's sort of labelled as pseudo-law. It's sort of not really law. It sort of looks like law, but it's not. But when we're talking about tribal law now, being this is a real thing that's coming back into existence now in terms of being codified and being seen on paper now. There's absolutely no way that this is pretend law, because it is real law. And that's why I think Irigala was saying there that, you know, this the law is on our side, and very much so, because we know that Indigenous peoples have rights because the rest of the world talks about them. So this is clearly something that has a strong foundation.
Absolutely. One of the things to understand in its essence is sovereignty is not a piece of paper. It's not even written on a piece of paper. Sure, it's a word, but it's actually a man or woman or child standing in their sovereignty, because they know, because they were here. We are that. All of the words come later. Just because someone else can write on a piece of paper that they have what we'll say importance over it because they wrote it, doesn't mean they were first. That just means they wrote it. The true sovereignty that we're talking about is the opportunity for someone to stand in their space where they grow up. This is their home. And this is something to understand. That is your sovereignty. And once you can build that, you'll understand that the true nature of that is stands in that itself. The rest of the paper now that we've put down is about that. It's about us now having that opportunity to be the first here. Remember the old rules that we're even just talking in workplaces, we're just talking about this, last on, first off. Well, in that precedence in itself, it's set, is to understand the fact that we're here first.
Yeah, I think first in time is often preferred at law.
Absolutely.
And obviously even the Australian system of legal, whatever it is, recognises that the sovereignty here of the tribes haven't been ceded or extinguished, for example. So I think in that case they're telling the truth. But although the piece of paper isn't what we're saying sovereignty, it's the correct description of things because it's the original language, the original title, as opposed to a foreign title or something else. For example, Robinson Crusoe goes and calls this man Friday. That's not his real name, but it was a title that Robinson Crusoe gave him, even though he was on his land. So the same way that Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones may describe an Australian of Aboriginal descent, that Aboriginal man or woman has an original name. In this case, it's Nuruku or Murumu or Dudu, Irigala. So these are they're not Australian personas as such. They are the tribal description of the men and the women are calling. And that is an important thing to realise, Nuruku, because when we're talking about law now, that's what really matters, is that it's not an Australian title we're talking about. This world is totally foreign to Australia.
Yeah, if I can also suggest to my mob to take up names, like my name used to be Elgin Buddy Leedy, but I refrain from using that any longer. That was a name given to me by my mother. And then when you think about Elgin, is a Scottish name. So I've told my wife and other family members, please don't call me that name no more. That was given to me. That was given to you. I said, I don't care. My new name now is Nuruku, meaning owl in my grandfather's language. And because the owl is our totem for Waka Waka Nation. Yeah. It's different up in the North Burnett. There's a scrub turkey. But I could take that name from that way as well because of my grandmother, Dad's mother, Pearly Carlo, which was originated from that country. But I've taken on my mum's side, around Nanango, her mother's from that way. Yeah.
Yeah, it's important. I think if you have an Australian name, then use it with honour and keep the constitution in line. But you can never be the king of Australia because that's Charles. So even in the Bible, Joseph was sold by his brothers into slavery. He went to the house of Potiphar in Egypt. They gave him an Egyptian name and a title, and he became second in charge of Egypt as the administrator. But he couldn't usurp or be number one over Pharaoh. So those things are there for a reason. That's the law. The same way that an Australian persona can't speak for Yidinji or for the Waka Waka, it has to be a Yidinji persona or something that has been established by the elders. And I think that's really important, Irigala, if you want to have a comment about that, because it's not anti this or that. It is really coming back and re-establishing, reinvigorating the law for the benefit of all.
Yes, I think it's interesting because for 240 years we have not even spoken to each other, the whites and the blacks, as we commonly call them. And now here we are forming nations together and we're doing all that together. And it's the first time we've actually worked together. And I hear a lot of the original people talking about bringing back their culture, but it's coming in ways like that. So in taking a tribal name and what it means, the language is coming back in, and also the customs. Like, one of the things we appreciate working with Nuruku is, and yourself, is that every day we're learning new things about your customs and traditions, and, oh, you know, we don't like that or we don't do this, and there's always good reason for it. So for the very first time after 240 years, we're actually learning from them, which I think is wonderful, and this is how the culture will come back now. I think it'll just roll on, because one of the things that we'll do with the land titles as we use the system that you have is we'll start naming places in Waka Waka language, and we'll start choosing street names and place names, and so it'll go from there.
Yeah, you can even see that today when you drive around the city of Ghimoi.
Yes.
For example, the Cairns High School now has Ghimoi right next to it.
Yes.
On the big stripes there. Yes. So, you know, there is an acceptance, or it's now the instruction by the governing body of that tribal territory or nation, rather, that can assist in those naming protocols and conventions.
It's interesting how you don't even realise till you look back and see, well, every little step makes a difference. And so every little step that's been taken and will continue to do so will have a big impact as it adds up and accumulates. We can't do everything overnight, like Nuruku said, but it will happen. And if we just keep taking positive action and it's in the right direction, it will have a big impact. I don't know how long. I don't have that bit of string.
That's great. We're coming to an end now, but I might just have some closing comments from the Foreign Minister and Nuruku as well.
Oh, yeah. The closing comments from me is this. We're just talking about the names. As an example, we've got Al and Irigala. Dudunum, it's Waka Wakan words, and one means throat and one means heart. Now, my character is my heart and I speak with my heart, and that's why my name is there. It's the whole point. It's about the meaning. So everything's been thought of, including how we go about the whole of this treaty together. It's about the meaning, because we work together and that's what we want to put across.
Thank you so much. And Nuruku, some final comments and words to people listening out there, might be your mob or whoever.
In closing, I just would like to mention about me being a born-again Christian. I always like to commence my meetings with the Lord God Almighty because of my Christianity, and give him all the thanks and glory, because I know I can't say these things or do it without him putting words in my mouth. Otherwise, I'd be so dumbfounded. So, because I'm reminded of a verse in the scripture where God says, without me, you can do nothing. So I've taken a note of that verse, and it's really dear to my heart as a born-again Christian. And everything we do in the Waka Waka Nation, we give God all the glory.
It's definitely a spiritual journey, and sovereignty is, being asserted on all levels, whether it's through codification and descriptions, but as you said, the naming and all that kind of stuff, there is a reason why we're doing this. You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today, thanks to our friends at Bumbavipra Media, 98.7 FM. We'll be back after the break. B-B-M. Yeah, well, there you go. It's been a big week. Ginyara and Yurilim, some final comments. The Waka Waka Yidinji Treaty is, this is what it's been set up to do. And it's great to see another nation have a crack at its governance model for its territory, and the Waka Waka Nation's been here a couple of times now, and it's very, very heartening to see what they're up to.
Oh, look, it really is. This is how it used to be, by the way, before the white fella come, before the European come. This is how it was. You know, the tribes had understanding amongst themselves. It wasn't written down, by the way, because it was passed on. Every generation this was passed on. Don't go and mess with them. This is their country. When they come to your country, they won't mess with you. You've got to respect each other's rights and responsibilities. So now we're putting it in writing, which is good to show the rest of the world that the Aboriginal people are united. They're not a broken, fractured world like what the everyday white fellow would like to think. You know, the Commonwealth Australia thinks, they're just a basket case. We've got to baby them. We've got to give them the soothing pillow to lie on while they die out. Well, no more. It's back. So it's great to see all this happen.